Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now in episode number 422. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm the pastor of Hope OPC up in Grays Lake, Illinois, and I'm back with a regular panelist. We have Jeff Waddington, who is stated supply at Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's good to have you with us today.
Oh, it's great to be here, brother.
Yes, we also have Jim Cassidy, as you may expect, who is the pastor of South Austin OPC in none other than Austin, Texas, keeping things weird down there in Austin. Welcome back, Jim.
Nobody expects me.
Nobody expects the Jim Cassidy. It's just like the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right. That's right. The Jim Cassidy Inquisition.
He's so Orthodox and Presbyterian, he's weird.
Yeah, that's isn't that the truth in more ways than one?
My wife and I were commenting, as kind of joking with ourselves yesterday. I won't tell you all the occasion of why, but I said at this point in time and with this particular interchange with certain people, I said, well, Erica, now not only are we strange to unbelievers, but in some regard, we're even strange to other Christians.
Yeah, that's long been the case for
sometimes
us.
Sometimes when you're Reformed and do traditional Reformed practices, you're just out of step, not only with with the world, but with Christendom, certainly with evangelicalism on certain things.
This is true.
Yeah. Well, today we're looking at speaking about the Confessional Presbyterian Journal, which has a new issue that should be on its way. In fact, by the time this episode airs, just in a couple days, no doubt many of you subscribers have already received your edition, so you can follow along and actually look at your copy as we discuss and speak about some things going on in there. Before we open up the journal and talk about its contents, just want to make a couple announcements and mentions. Last night, we just held a Reformed Forum board meeting, so Jim and Jeff and I have been on Skype all night long. In fact, we just got done with the board meeting at 9:30 a.m. this morning, and now, no, I'm kidding. But it seems like we've been pulled an all-nighter. We had a good meeting and a lot of great things going on, and just, again, reminded of the wonderful support of all of our listeners, and we want to thank you for all of that, and we want to say that we have some really fun stuff lined up and made some important decisions. We're hopefully laying a foundation for many years to come, but we've got a lot of ideas and a lot of projects lined up, and we're hopefully going to start attacking those bit by bit. But, of course, we encourage you to visit us online and continue your support at reformedforum.org/donate. We also encourage you to send us some notes at mail@reformedforum.org or just tweet us at Reformed Forum. We love hearing from you. If you have any questions or comments or thoughts or ideas for future episodes, anything of the sort, send them along. We love to follow up with you. So thanks so much for your support and also your interaction, and mostly just for listening and being an encouraging force in our lives and helpful. We really appreciate knowing that there are people out there that have been blessed by this organization, and we praise the Lord and thank Him for all that He's done, and thank you for all your support. So just want to say that to all of our listeners, and hope to hear from you soon. So, Jim and Jeff, we've been involved with and have known about the Confessional Presbyterian Journal for quite some time. Jim, would you just maybe a refresher or explain to our listeners your involvement? And Jeff, you can as well, but
sure.
How have you brothers come into working alongside and for the journal?
Well, Chris Caldwell, who is the chief editor of the magazine, does a great job with it. What you'll notice once you pick it up is the high quality nature of the printing and of the typesetting and all this other stuff. I had purchased the first volume of the journal when it initially came out and was really impressed with it. So I complimented Chris on his work and asked if I could contribute an article to the second issue. He graciously accepted that article. And after then, he said, you know, would you be interested in helping out? I need some editing assistance and such. And I see that, you know, you're favorable towards the journal. I said, great, love to be a part of it. And so we've been doing it for, I guess I've been working with Chris for just about 10 years or 9 years, I guess it is. We're in volume 11 at this point, and this is actually the 2015 issue, even though it's been released in 2016. You know, we had some snags along the way in 2015, so it delayed its release. The good news is we are hoping to release volume 12. We're working very aggressively before the General Assemblies in
June. Are you serious? Wow.
Yeah, so we're going to try to get ourselves back on the routine of getting the journal out in time for the General Assemblies of, you know, the PCA and OPC. So that's how I got involved, and Jeff can fill in his story as well.
Well, basically because I know Jim, and I believe I began, Jim, with the second issue in which your article was found. I don't think I have the first issue. I'd have to go back and look at my copies, but like you, I was impressed with the quality of it, of the content, but also of the layout. I always, you know, I've always wondered why people thought it was wise to combine excellent content with ugly formatting. I guess it was to test whether we really were interested in the content.
Believe this.
But no, it's
like those Dendalk issues of Van Til. I'm very grateful that those exist because that's what we had for so many years. But at the same time, sometimes it's difficult to read.
Oh, like those Puritan classics, the greenbound ones, you know, like good material, but hard on the eyes.
Yeah, it could be tough.
So we're interested in doing both good, excellent content, but also an excellent layout, which is what we strive to do. And so I think I've been involved for 3 or 4 years, I think. So not nearly as long as Jim, but been glad to come on board to help Chris with the publication.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it is true. We are on track to actually get volume 12 out before the General Assemblies.
Now, I know there's been some important developments of recent years. These are now database indexed, aren't they?
They are ATLA.
Yeah,
indexed.
That's the big one, I think.
Yeah, don't think that you can get. I don't think you can access yet PDFs of it through ATLA.
But that's true for a lot of journals. Just having it indexed is a huge improvement, and it makes it more discoverable for other scholars.
Yeah. And it helps in terms of research.
It's a big deal. But the one thing I think people recognize first off is the layout, but even just the cover. And ever since the beginning, I believe, there have been commissioned portraits which are painted by Mike Mahon, if I'm correct. And it seems that that is the case yet again for issue number 11. Who's on the cover this time?
Well, we have Professor John Murray on the cover this year. Mike Mahon has done a great job for us over the years in terms of painting portraits of different, you know, our different what I oftentimes call our cover boys. The GQ man of this year is John Murray, and he did a great job again for us. And as you'll notice in the past issues, he does a great job in terms of color and really kind of you know, putting something very attractive out there. This year, we are featuring John Murray, and hopefully by June we'll have another cover. We can't say yet who is going to be on the cover, but I can say that the issue is going to revolve around the issue of the Doctrine of the Sabbath. So that look out for that come June. Yeah.
We also wanted to note that this is our annual swimsuit issue.
Oh, geez. I did not want to see John Murray in a swimsuit. I'm sorry.
No, you do not.
I probably didn't own one. Was a kilt.
He probably, like Lloyd Jones, he wore a full suit and hat down to the beach if he ever went.
All right. I don't like where this is going. What's in this journal? Really?
I think Jeff already told us.
Oh, well.
Well, anyway, in all seriousness, we have the opening piece after the editorial is a little bio piece by Danny Olinger. Danny put together a very nice summary of John Murray and his life. So I'd want to commend that one to everyone. And then immediately following that, we have John Murray's piece on the regulative principle of worship and song in the public worship of God. What many people don't know is that Murray was quite instrumental and quite active on the level of the General Assembly of the OPC. And one time the General Assembly had a study committee on song and public worship, and John Murray was on that committee, ended up writing, Jeff, correct me on this if I don't have it accurate, but he wrote the Minority Report, I believe.
On, it would be the Minority Report.
Minority Report in terms of the, singing exclusively Psalms. That was his conviction, was singing Psalms only. And Jeff has the distinct privilege, actually, of filling a pulpit right now where John Murray actually preached from.
Yes, and attended whenever he wasn't preaching elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many people know this, but his membership was actually in the Presbytery of New York and New England, not Philadelphia, where you might have expected that. He was involved with preaching, you know, in the summer he would go up to Canada, and there are interesting stories connected with that. But so this is his argument presented to the General Assembly, arguing for, I believe, exclusive psalm singing in public worship. And the congregation I serve holds to that commitment as well.
I don't want to put you on the spot here, Jeff, but I will.
Sure.
About John Murray and New England, and it kind of takes us a little bit of an aside, but since the it is featuring Murray, I think this is an important aspect of his life that we can maybe highlight. But I understand that, having been a member of the Presbytery of New York and New England, wasn't he part of, I don't know if it was an inner OPC ministry, but something with regard to the propagation of the gospel in New England or something? It was some sort of an attempt to do church planting in the New England area?
Yes, I was going to say, that's actually the fullest extent of my knowledge, is that he was involved in church planting in New England. And of course, there is a greater Reformed presence between the various Reformed denominations than there was back in those days when Professor Murray was involved with that. But beyond that, I don't know the exact nature of his work. That would be an interesting subject for an article.
No, it really would. I mean, it really would be. I think his widow, Valerie, and son lived up in New England.
Augusta, Maine.
Yeah, that's right.
There was a congregation there. Oddly enough, I think it was still active when I served in Augusta in my former life as a Salvation Army officer. I would be curious to where it was located. Augusta is a city on two sides of a river. So it's divided by that waterway going down the center of the Kennebec River.
I think his son is still alive, in fact, and serves or as an elder maybe in one of the OP works up there. I don't know if you've heard anything about that.
No, I think I've heard something to that effect.
He would be in his Dr. Murray, what year did he get married? He was married after he retired from Westminster.
Yeah.
So after 66, that means his son would be younger than me.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyways, that's interesting. You'll want to read that, even if you don't agree with it. You can see the logic of the exclusive psalm singing argument.
Sure. Jeff, you want to take us through the rest of the contents and what's
sure.
Issue?
Nick Wilburn has an article on sanctification and law and good works and their relationship within the American Reformed tradition. Now, of course, that's a topic that is debated even now.
Oh,
so that is a current issue, current event, if you will. Even though he's dealing with it, the history of it, it should be good because we see that it's a perennial issue that comes back to us again and again. And I'm sure if we were to look in our archive, we would discover that we have quite a few episodes that would touch upon this theme.
Oh, Yeah, a ton. What kind of propositions or do you have a thesis in there? I mean, is he just laying out an historical survey? What kind of interesting findings?
Brother Wilburn is looking at things from a historical perspective, and he's going to, in their survey, from what I understand, the best of the Northern Presbyterian and Southern Presbyterian tradition. Of course, his dissertation, Jeff, I think, is on Gerardo. Is that correct?
Gerardo? Okay.
Gerardo, the Southern Presbyterian minister. Is that correct?
Hmm.
That you could be right. You've caught me in an area where I'll have to ask him. How this works, just so that you understand, we each of us there's we have three articles editors, Jim, is that right?
At least, yeah.
Yeah. So we each are assigned a certain number of the articles, and we don't necessarily all see them before publication. So that's why we're doing a little stumbling around here. But Nick's work is always solid. Everything that he's produced that I've seen has been very good. So I'm sure this will be a solid chapter.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah, and then, by the way, Nick is one of our fellow editors as well.
Yes, he is. I meant to say that.
Yep.
He's a fellow articles editor. This is followed by Joseph Rollison on the Church's Care for the Penitent, Some Considerations. It sounds like it would be a very interesting chapter dealing with a person who's repenting, you know, of their sin, right? How do you, without knowing exactly what how it's tackled, but being how pastorally do you handle the person who's already, I guess, under conviction at this point? So that will be interesting. That's followed by an article or a chapter by Ben Shaw on an exposition of Psalm 68. Ben, as you, our listeners will know, is a professor of Old Testament at Greenville Seminary.
Interesting. I see the next one is by Mark Jones, Strange Bedfellows, Darwinism, and the Reformed Theological Tradition.
You know, this is, again, a historical theological piece where Mark looks at the Reformed tradition, how the Reformed tradition dealt with the issue of evolutionism, Darwinism, Darwinianism, and so he of course spends a good deal of time on Warfield and the old Princeton tradition and surveys kind of where that goes, and that's always a pretty knotty issue because in today's context, I think we would safely all say, or that we all should say, that Darwinian evolutionism, and not just Darwinian evolutionism, but even what some have styled theistic evolutionism, would be outside the bounds of confessional fidelity.
Yes.
And yet, the old Princeton tradition wasn't always very strongly opposing the a theistic evolution perspective, although certainly Hodge was very clear to say that Darwinian evolutionism, which is atheistic in its orientation, or at least deistic, is of course out of bounds. But it's a little dicey in that old Prince tradition.
Now there's dispute, of course. Now Fred Zaspel has, I think, has challenged the consensus, for instance, that Warfield was a theistic evolutionist.
Yeah.
In his study on the theology of Warfield, and it would be Mark Knoll and David Livingstone who were the I think the most recent advocates of Warfield holding to a theistic evolutionary view. So that's a question that I don't know if Mark deals with. Does he deal with that debate at all in the article?
Well, I don't believe he interacts closely with Zaspel's work. So,
okay.
But anyway, that is, you know, the area of coverage. And, you know, it is, you know, the question, I'll say this, you know, it doesn't seem like, at least from Mark's article, that Warfield would be an advocate of theistic evolution. But he also doesn't really come out with kind of a definitive nine, you know,
right.
kind of
right.
something, you know, really kind of clear. And Machen didn't, of course, either. He kind of played the agnostic card. I don't mean agnostic about the existence of God, but agnostic with regard to the science behind evolution. And we also have to understand that old Princeton was working really within the shadow of the initial kind of dust up over the topic of evolution, and they don't have the years of kind of reflection to see where it has gone over the last 100 years and such. So maybe we wouldn't blame them for not being as clear-minded about this as we are standing 100 years later.
I don't know about Miller and Alexander.
They would have preceded.
Hodge would have been, I think, a gradualist in terms of his understanding of the creation narrative. Mm-hmm. And so that opens up the field.
Explain what you mean by gradualist.
Well, there's developmentalism. It's in the air, the whole idea of organicism.
Well, now you've used three words that you don't
need
to define.
Yes, I have. Well, in other words, that the creation account, according to, and again, I'm going off the top of my head here, that Hodge would have, Hodge, I think, bought into the gap theory. Is that right? I forget now which view he advocated in terms of creation. So he's already, you know, if like me, you're a 6/24 hour guy, and I know, so I would see him as already compromised in his view of creation, apart from the issue of evolution. See, evolution is a form of gradualism. Okay, that's what I was trying to get at. Evolution is a kind of gradualism. The God that does things by long processes is rather than by, divine fiat.
Or immediately.
Or immediate. Well, that's what I mean by immediate work. But anyways, so that sounds like an interesting topic. The next article is by Richard Barcelos, who is a Reformed Baptist brother. It's a Christian ministry in the church. It's reasons, duration, goal, and practical effects. And he's looking at Ephesians 4:11-16.
But you know, Richard is kind of a Presbyterian. I mean, he's
That's
really
true.
Close. Yeah.
That's right. Very, very, very close. But his article is dealing with basically challenging the notion of I guess every member ministry in the sense of that there's nothing different or unique about pastoral ministry.
And he interacts with T. David Gordon on that verse, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. He's going to take Richard is going to take the position that Paul is teaching the special role of the pastor or minister.
Just for listeners, there's a bit of a debate on whether there should be a comma in there or not. Firm Poitras, for one, sees it exegetically could go either way, but that's a large debate on whether it's the minister's job or to do the work of the ministry, or whether it's every Christian's job to do the work of the ministry, which in some measure depends on how you define the ministry.
Right.
And so that's an ongoing exegetical debate that has practical theological implications.
Yes, and that I think Rich makes his case, which is kind of why I recommended it being included in the accepted for publication. So I guess it's
a very good article.
Yeah.
Very, very, very well done. And of course, you know, we're we're tongue in cheek, and when Rich hears this, he's going to have a smile on his face as we're taking our little jabs, as we do on places like Facebook, at each other. But it's all good brotherly fun. Now, I don't know anything about the next article, so.
Oh, that's right. It's the next article is "Let's Do Presbyterianism: The Trinitarian Foundations, the Biblical Church Polity" by somebody named James J. Cassidy.
I think he's Baptist too.
Yeah, I think so. But he's an Arminian or Free Will Baptist. Jim gave this as a presentation at our most recent Reform Forum conference back in October in Grays Lake, Illinois. Tell us about it, Jim.
Yeah, it's simply what I'm trying to do is to take the Trinitarian framework in understood in terms of the one in many as the ground for our church polity as Presbyterians. and what I get there by doing a broad sweep biblical theology of the one in many. So begin, of course, with God as the triune God of Scripture, who is the, to use maybe Van Til's expression, the absolute one in many, and who forms the ontological ground for the unity and distinction of creation. And I trace that through redemptive historically to cover, you know, the various loci, including how it applies to the doctrine of the covenant of grace, how it applies to the doctrine of common grace, how it applies to ecclesiology as well, and wanting to show how Presbyterianism seeks to maintain that balance between the one and the many, the unity of the church and its diversity, especially reflected within the session and the eldership of the church, which also has a unity in plurality type of distinction as well. So I try to trace that through and try to show forth the God-centered nature of our ecclesiology.
Very nice. I was present for that presentation, so I could tell you it was a good, enjoyable presentation. Mm.
And the recording for that's available online. I'll place a link to it in the episode description.
Okay. Jim is followed by Carl Truman. James Bannerman's The Church of Christ, A Tract for These Times, and this is based on his remarks at the unveiling of a new edition of Bannerman's Church of Christ, the new single volume that Banner of Truth has produced, which is retypeset, makes it easier on the eyes, and Carl wrote the foreword for that, or the introduction for the new edition. Carl gave the presentation at the unveiling of the Bannerman's, the reprinting of Bannerman's book, and with him he was joined by Jonathan Lehman of Nine Marks Ministries and Nathan Sasser of Sovereign Grace, and they had some good discussion. They had panel discussion as well as individual presentations. So this was Carl's presentation explaining how Bannerman's work, though it's over 100 years old, still very useful for our present day. And his introduction is followed by a work by James Bannerman entitled Rites and Ceremonies in Public Worship. So you get a taste of Bannerman's. By the way, James Bannerman was a preeminent Scottish theologian on practical theology, churches to history, polity, that kind of thing. And one of the things you'll note if you haven't yet read Bannerman's work on the Church of Christ is that his understanding of pastoral or practical theology and the typical understanding of that today are very different. Very often today, practical theology is heavy on practical and light on theology. And you don't find that in Bannerman at all. So Bannerman is followed by what looks like a very fascinating article on Holy Communion and Revivalism and the First Awakening.
We just had a recent episode where you and, well, Jim, you and Glenn Clary and Daryl Hart and John Terpstra had some discussions about revivalism here. Is that any in any way related to Glenn's article?
Yeah, actually, in many ways it is. You know, that discussion, the best thing to do perhaps is to direct our listeners to check out that episode. I don't know what episode number it was, but it has to do with the issue of...
I can link to that too.
Yeah, link to that in the show notes. And then, yeah, it has to do with the relationship between covenantal nurture and the kind of experientialism of the Great Awakening, and how the Great Awakening historically affected the church's doctrine of communion and the Lord's Supper, and how and in what ways the revivals played into the actual practice of communion as well, because there were significant implications for the way in which the Presbyterian Church here in America began to not only understand and theologically articulate Holy Communion, but also the way in which it practiced it. And of course, there's a, you know, back and forth, as Jeff was saying, relationship between practice and theology. That is happening, and the revivals do affect the way, even down to today, that we view and understand the doctrine of the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. So, yeah, Glenn goes in and kind of, you know, documents all of that. So, of course, if you listen to the show and to that episode with us four, and it was controversial maybe for a reason, because in the article there's a critical interaction with the Great Awakening, wanting to show and argue that maybe not all aspects of the Great Awakening contributed positively, especially with regard to the way in which the church viewed and understood the sacrament.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. My own take, apart from the sacrament issue, is that it's a between nurture and revival, and I would say evangelism more than revivalism, because revivalism, the definition of revival that the revivalists themselves offered is in my opinion too wide, too broad. It covers everything from revitalization of a moribund church to evangelism and discipleship, and anything where there's spiritual vitality in the Christian life or in the church. And I think that's not necessarily a helpful definition of revival. So, but in terms of the revival versus nurture, I think it's a false dilemma, because nurture is what I would expect from the Christian family. However, we are called as the church to proclaim the gospel to the unbelieving community as well. And that means, therefore, that you're going to be dealing with people who haven't been nurtured in the church. So in that sense, you're confronting unbelief, and you will not have had Christian nurture. Mm-hmm. So it's pardon me for raining perhaps on the parade, but it's a false it's an unnecessary argument to a certain extent. So I have not listened to that episode. I must apologize. But anyways, that leads into the next article.
Yeah.
How Free Was Adam's Will? Examining Jean Lafayette Girardot's critique of Jonathan Edwards' view of Adam's will before the fall.
I feel like I'm in Inception. They're like four levels deep here. We're talking about Adam's will, and then one guy's view of another guy's view of another historical another guy view. Written by another guy. You know, so.
Exactly. Four I have levels not read deep. This, so I don't know whether I would agree or not agree with Caleb Cangalosi, who has written it. I in my dissertation, of course, have dealt with this issue, and I have my own criticisms of Edwards' notion of how Adam fell, which would be related to how free was his will.
This came up at the conference, didn't it? We kind of struggled around in light of this question, if I remember, during the pre-conference.
Yes, I believe when we were talking with Lane Tipton, and that's available, I believe, on our website, right?
Oh yeah,
So that'll be interesting to me to read what Caleb has written. I know that Girardeau and his name went right out of my head. Dabney, Robert Louis Dabney, were critical of Edwards at points. Whether I agree with them or not is beside the point. But so that'll be interesting, and of course, it's especially interesting in light of the next article which I wrote, which comes first, The Intellect or the Will, Alvin Plantinga and Jonathan Edwards on a Perennial Question.
Yeah, we did a whole episode on this.
Yeah,
one,
we did.
We
did. So it's we're familiar territory. It's basically interacting with Plantinga's interaction with Edwards and whether Plantinga is nuanced enough. But at the end of the day, I basically say Plantinga is closer to Edwards than he thinks or than he thought. It's based on the interaction with Edwards in Warranted Christian Belief, which is now 16 years old.
Wow.
And I don't remember whether there's any of this discussion makes it into the briefer treatment that has recently been released. Plantinga kind of created a condensation of Warranted Christian Belief that was published recently. I forget the title of the book, but so that's that comes from my work in my dissertation.
I was about to ask, is that a chapter in the book that you just published?
It's an extraction, so it's not the whole chapter.
Gotcha.
Because there's material in the chapter that's extraneous to planning a. It's not extraneous to the district to the book, mm-hmm. but it is extraneous to that particular issue.
Now, I mean, anyone who wants to learn more about this subject and Edwards on not just apologetics, but also Edwards' kind of system of theology as a whole, in so much as we could talk about Jonathan Edwards' system, needs to pick up that book. Not to get a shameful plug here for you, but what's the title, the full title?
The Unified Operations of the Human Soul, Theological Anthropology and Apologetic of Jonathan Edwards, or Jonathan Edwards' Theological Anthropology and Apologetic.
Okay. So, and what nice short title, concise.
Well, you know, it's like a Puritan title, right?
It's a Puritan title. That's
except
right.
I can't say that there's no blurbs on the back cover.
Yeah, well.
Reason the Puritans did that was because they didn't have such things as blurbs or descriptions, right? So you had to go by the title of the book.
Yeah, you had to judge a book by its title, I guess. So, and that's available, you know, like on Amazon and all that?
Amazon, a Westminster bookstore, directly from Wiffenstock. So any of your normal book outlets will have the book. I know the Westminster Bookstore does have it. You can go online and go to one of your favorite bookseller. Mm-hmm. The benefit of going to the Westminster Bookstore, of course, is that you are supporting the ministry of the seminary by doing that.
Yeah, that wasn't a shameless plug though. That was a shameful plug that we exercised. No, that's fine. Moving on.
Wow. So my article is followed by one by Barry Waugh entitled "William Perkins, Augustine's Protege and Father of Puritan Theology." So William Perkins, a name that many would be familiar with, his "Art of Prophesying," which is a book on preaching. Many people are familiar with that, and I think The Art of Man Fishing, another book that Perkins has written. And the really nice thing is Reformation Heritage Books has started publishing the complete works of William Perkins, which haven't been in print since the original printing back in the 1600s or 1700s, maybe even the 1500s. Perkins is called the father of Puritan theology. I believe he taught at Cambridge University in England. Well-known preacher, and one to whom we need to look if we want to understand our Reformed heritage. Jim, what's the next chapter?
Well, the next chapter is what our chief editor affectionately calls the Bah Humbug piece of this particular issue, which is on the religious observance of Christmas by American Presbyterianism. So the editors have various and sundry views when it comes to the church calendar in some respects. I think we're all agreed that the church calendar is not something that, you know, we're not Lent observers or such, but, you know, some of us have stronger convictions about what the Continental Reformed have called the evangelical or the evangelical feasts, which would include Christmas and Easter and two others, Pentecost and such. So some of us are more open to the observance than others, and Chris Caldwell, our good brother, is definitely a Scrooge when it comes to that. And so this is his Bah Humbug piece.
Ah, yes. And
that really touches a nerve with people if you start bringing some of that stuff up.
I wouldn't say that I flip out so much as I just say, hey, look, I'm joining the Magi, the shepherds, and the angels in celebrating the birth of Christ.
Yeah.
There you go. Did you say you're a magician?
Magoy.
It's my cheap shot, you know. It's interesting that a lot of folk don't realize that Reformed Presbyterian circles historically that there was at least a big portion of our heritage that people did not celebrate Christmas.
Right.
Sometimes when you go to historical landmarks in the U.S. and without naming names, and they have big Christmas celebrations, I'm thinking, I do believe they outlawed this originally. But anyway, so that'll be an interesting chapter. That's followed by Sic et Non, and then which is on the
we should just pause to talk about that debate.
This is the content of Song for Public Worship of God. So it's going back to the issue that John Murray deals with at the beginning of the issue.
The debate over exclusive psalmody.
Yes.
I believe that Andy Webb gives the pro-hymns position. And in RPC, RPCNA brother, who I think is Dennis Prutow in this one, even though the names aren't put under here in the table of contents, does the psalmist, the exclusive psalmist position. And so it's an exchange, kind of a written exchange over, you know, the question of exclusive psalmody in worship.
Right. I think you can find on the web a debate between Denny Prutow and T. David Gordon on the same topic. That was held at the RPCNA seminary in Pittsburgh. So you also, if you're interested after reading this, to go to that, you'll get to see. Denny Prutow is known for as a homiletics instructor as well. He's published a book on preaching, as well as material on this particular question. So the Sic et Non is we've changed the topic. It's the exclusive psalm singing and worship. And this is followed by reviews and responses. The first review is written by somebody I know, and it's on Franciscus. It's on Franciscus Unius's The Mosaic Polity, which is a delightful little book written back in the 1500s, finally translated from the Latin into English just in the last and published last year by the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
A fine, very little, important book, and an important republication there.
Yeah, a very good book on, because what you discover, as we often do when we read the Reformed Scholastics, is that they've actually dealt with issues that we think are new, and discover that they already were familiar. For instance, I'll give you one example. Often we hear criticisms of the tripart distinction between the ceremonial, judicial, and moral law. And Junius deals with that issue and recognizes that those distinctions were never meant to be hard and fast. In other words, a particular law in the Mosaic Covenant might cross boundaries. In other words, it might be moral and civil or moral and ceremonial. And so it's interesting to read what he says about this. Junius was a, I guess what we would call today an establishmentarian. You'll discover that with Calvin, he believes that the magistrate has the obligation to uphold both the first and the second table of the law given in the Ten Commandments. That's an issue for debate in our own day, you know, whether we should expect the magistrate to uphold both tables of the law. So you look for that. We have a review by Carl Truman on Gerald Bray's book, God Has Spoken. And Jim, you want to talk about the others?
Sure. Yeah. Ben Shaw has a review of correctly handling the Word of God, Reformed Hermeneutics Today, a book that I'm not familiar with, but sounds interesting. And then a volume by N.T. Wright is entitled Surprised by Scripture, Engaging Contemporary Issues. Jeff Stuyvesant, our friend, RPCNA friend from the Pittsburgh area, and fellow Westminster PhD who wrote, I believe, on Warfield. Is that right?
Correct. That's correct.
Yeah, Jeff Stuyvesant. And he's also Jeff has also written very well, I know, for us at Reform Forum. He's got a few very good blog posts on Reform Forum, and I think he's also written for you guys over at ACE as well. Is that correct?
He has. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah. He's actually one of the editors at the Place for Truth.
Good. That's right. Very good. So always worth reading, Jeff. So check that one out. And then let's see. Wes Brendenhoff has reviewed a copy of Synopsis. Oh, hey, you got to help me out here with the Latin.
Synopsis,
Jeff.
Purioris Theologiae.
Right,
or the Synopsis of Pure Theology. Which was a major text in its day and was revised or edited. There was an edited edition that Herman Bavinck edited back in the 19th century.
Oh, interesting.
So this is volume one. So there's more volumes to follow. I believe it's a Brill publication.
Oh, so that means it's going to be too expensive for any of us. Okay.
Yeah. It's what can we do? But it is a major work in terms of scholastic literature. So it's one that you can at least borrow from the library, and it has both the Latin and the English translation side by side.
It's a diglot.
It would be a diglot. That's correct.
And Van Asselt edited. Is that?
Yeah, that's correct. So he's no longer with us. He passed.
Yeah, he just passed away, right?
Yeah. So this I don't know if this was his last work or one of his last works.
Hmm.
But anyways, this is a major work from the Scholastic era, and know that it was considered worth public republishing by Herman Bavinck, and in fact, he cites from this work consistently throughout his four-volume Reform Dogmatics.
Important stuff. And then we get one of my favorite kind of regular sections or departments in the journal, which is Sallow on Psalm 92, 1 through 15. And I'm not sure. I don't know. I wish we had Chris on because he kind of oversees these departments and the stuff that gets in there. And I'm not sure where he gets it, but the music and all that from, but it's every issue has a psalm set to music with some commentary and explanation. It's a neat little department that we have every year.
Yeah.
Yep. And really that cool. That is followed by In Trans Latione. And this episode, this issue includes Johannes Walabius's Praecognita of Christian Theology from his Compendium of Theologiae Christianae, that Compendium of Christian Theology.
Are you speaking in tongues again, Jeff?
I actually. No, I'm not. It's actually a known tongue, which I've studied. So I can't claim any divine afflatus, as we call it.
There you go again.
So I'm assuming this is dealing with the presuppositions of Christian theology, praecognita, the preconditions. When we talk about Van Til, I've not seen it, so I can't say anything more than that. It'll be interesting to see if he's in line with, say, Franciscus Unius and talking about the archetype-ectype distinction. But that's, I'm assuming that's what that's about.
If I have my memory correct, and I believe it's Ryan McGraw who does that translation. Is that?
Oh, okay.
Do you remember that?
I do not remember.
Okay, so that's worth looking at. I believe there's translation, maybe some commentary and background on the work. And of course, Ryan McGraw is always worth reading. I believe Ryan has a piece coming out this year in the 2016 issue. Yes. And that's going to be on the doctrine of the Sabbath. So, and Ryan is an OP minister who many of our listeners will know, just called to be a professor at Greenville Seminary. And his family has moved there, and he's taken up his labors teaching at the seminary. And Ryan's a fine scholar that's always worth reading and seeing what he has to say.
And I should note that the last time we mentioned him, I said I was will be reviewing his dissertation, and I believe I called it a heavenly dictionary. No, it's a heavenly directory, and it's on John Owen and Christian worship.
I'm hoping there's no dictionaries in heaven.
Well, there may only be one for you, Jim. It's, you know.
I hope I don't.
As long
need
as it has the pronunciation instructions for people from New Jersey, I think.
Yeah, especially it has a long section on how to pronounce the word recognize.
Recognize. Jim has some trouble with that. That's all right. We appreciate it.
My Jersey gets in the way. I understand that heaven is going to be in New Jersey and everybody's going to have a Jersey accent.
Right? Wow. Okay.
That's what I heard. It's there in the text.
So you're a transformationalist, huh?
Yeah, you'd have to be. You'd have to be. Well, this looks overall like a very strong issue. I know. I mean, I'm looking forward to receiving mine. Should be in the mail. Might be in the mailbox here in a couple hours. Who knows? But I'll take a look at it. Always appreciate the work of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal. You can visit them online at cpjournal.com if you would like to subscribe. You can also buy issues, I think, one at a time.
Except for volume one.
And you could buy older. Yeah, you could definitely order older issues too, except some of the back issues are gone.
Unless you're able to find a used copy that someone wants to sell. Yeah. But
well, good luck. happy providence. That could be the case, but yeah. So I don't, you know, if your library doesn't have it, we also encourage your library to get a copy. The Westminster Library in Philadelphia has picked it up for many years. They have it. If you have a theological library nearby, suggest to them that they look into subscribing, but we also encourage all of the listeners to subscribe for themselves. They're very nice volumes, and they're not only nice to read, large format and good typesetting, but they're also kind of a nice little thing to have up on the shelf. And there's so much good material in there, and the focus of the journal is very helpful and useful and distinct. So it's an important work, and we're glad that it continues to go on. And we look forward to this episode and this issue, but also perhaps even another one by June. Should be pretty interesting. CPJournal.com. Of course, you can find out information about what we're up to and more information about our other programs. Visit us online at reformedforum.org. I encourage you at the bottom of the page toward the right in the footer also to subscribe to our email list. More information to come there, and we'll try to keep you apprised of new projects even as we discuss them and announce them here on our programs. I've got a whole spat of emails I need to send out for guests. So we're looking to be booking and scheduling a host of new guests for episodes of Christ the Center. So there's been so many books, especially in the last quarter, that we haven't been able to get to. And I have them all in a stack and ready on my shelf. And it's a matter of booking. And sometimes there's a lot of lead time involved. But stick with us. And we're looking forward to a whole host of great new episodes here to finish out January, get into February and March, and a lot of good stuff coming up. So we encourage you to visit us online, reformedforum.org. Visit us there. We want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.